For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
So, good evening, everyone. I'm very pleased to have with us this evening Joe Gioia, who's a regular, longtime regular practitioner here, to speak about his book, The Guitar and the New World, A Fugitive History. I want to introduce it, and I'll try not to be too lengthy, but actually I want to talk about why I think this book is really important to our practice. It's a fascinating book, and I think it's an important book. Dogen, our 13th century Japanese founder of Soto Zen that we follow here, says to study the way is to study the self. And so for us, we're here doing this, trying to follow this ancient Asian Buddhist practice as Americans. And part of studying the self for us is to see how it is to practice as Americans and what our and what that means and what America is. And so the subtitle of Joe's book is A Fugitive History. And really, there's so much in this book. In some ways, the book is about the fugitive, ephemeral, ungraspable nature of history itself. So he covers a lot of material. I think one of the focuses of the book that I think Joe's going to talk about a lot tonight is the blues. And, well, he talks also about the history of the guitar, which is so central to our modern culture, but also the Native American, surprisingly, roots of the blues. But there's also a lot about... And we have a copy of the book in our library, and there's a few copies for sale afterwards if you're interested. But he talks about his family history from Italy and region where his family settled. But what does it mean to be American? What does it mean? What is it we're doing as American Zen people? I talked yesterday about. This week is the 50th anniversary of Dr. King's "I Have a Dream" speech, and what is our dream, and what is what does it mean to be here? So, part of our study of ourselves is to see how it is to take on the way here. And part of that, Buddhism is an earth religion. When the Buddha awakened, he touched the ground, he touched the earth. And so what Joe has uncovered in his research is how, of course, the blues, grew up in the Delta and in Chicago with Muddy Waters and Howling Wolf. And I don't want to take all of the stuff you're going to talk about, but, to look at the ground of Native Americans, and this land is really important for us. So anyway, it's a really fascinating book. I think it's a really important book, and I'm really happy that you're here to talk to us about it, Joe. So thank you.
Thank you, Tygon. It was a wonderful introduction, and I very much appreciate the opportunity to come here and read and talk about the book. Anyone looking for a sort of linear telling of the history of the guitar is going to be very disappointed in the book. I move around a lot and discuss, as already alluded to, a lot of different things. There's a family chronicle, which is sort of forming my initial inquiry. My grandmother's older brother was a guitar maker in Buffalo, New York, which is something I didn't know until I started playing the guitar myself and was told by my father's older brother about this family connection. And so I started from that making these different inquiries. And I would say that I took as a sort of a guiding principle that everything is connected. And so, you sort of follow one line of inquiry, and others sort of present themselves, and you have to follow those too. So after much work, I finished up with the book. I'm going to read different sections and maybe take some time in between. If people have questions, I can then answer them as we go along, or I can just go through and read all the stuff and then have time for questions after that. So I will start. I should say that the book is sort of arranged so that I sort of talk about my great uncle, and then there's a period in Buffalo, the history of Buffalo, New York, that I talk about, and then we sort of get to the center of the book, which is where I consider the origins of American music, which is where I'm going to start right now. In the summer of 1901, the anthropologist Charles Peabody, while excavating a pre-Columbian Indian mound in the Mississippi Delta at Coahoma, became, he said, distracted by strange music. Professor Peabody is not remembered now for any artifacts he uncovered, but for what he discovered in the air, what he called the extraordinary sounds of the black men working for him. 2 years later, in Notes on Negro Music, published in the Journal of American Folklore, Peabody said the men singing was unlike anything he'd heard before, something he described as autochthonous music, of which it is hard to give an exact account. The music of the Negroes may be put under three heads: the songs sung by our men when at work digging, unaccompanied, the songs of the same men at quarters or on the march, with guitar accompaniment, and the songs unaccompanied of the indigenous Negroes. By indigenous, he meant the men hired in Coahoma, rather than those brought from Clarksdale 10 miles away. Peabody noted the popularity of hymns, and that the guitar playing was mostly ragtime, with the instrument seldom venturing beyond the inversions of the three chords of a few major and minor keys. Of great interest to later folklorists was Peabody's remark that, in the song of one mule driver in particular, he heard strains of apparently genuine African music, long phrases that were without apparent measured rhythm, singularly hard to copy in notes. One evening, Peabody heard a woman singing a lullaby, weird in interval and strange in rhythm, particularly beautiful, and compared it to something like contemporary Greek singing, albeit better done. There was another singer, a very old Negro employed in the plantation of Mr. John Stovall of Stovall, Mississippi. His voice, as he sang, had a timbre resembling a bagpipe played pianissimo, or a jew's harp played legato, and to some indistinguishable words he hummed a rhythm of no regularity and notes of apparently not more than three or more in number at intervals within a semitone. The effect, again, was monotonous but weird, not far from Japanese. When researchers in the 1960s began an academic search for the roots of blues music, Peabody's account was considered crucial evidence of time and place. Stovall and the neighboring Dockery Plantation were already recognized to be the home ground for a generation of musicians born between 1880 and 1910, who made records that embody what has been regarded by many later listeners as the essential blues, a black man's conjuring of hard times with a voice and a guitar. However, Peabody had qualified his observations in notes with a word that music writers tend to ignore. He wrote, apparently, when citing genuine African origin. Going forward, the assumption has been that the music could only be African. Left unconsidered also is exactly how much African music Peabody was familiar with. More definitely, he had compared what he heard to Japanese music, which, considering the 19th century fad for Oriental arts in elite Victorian Boston, was probably something he had at least a passing familiarity with, if only by way of the Mikado. More likely, Peabody imputed African origin to what he heard strictly on the basis of the skin color of the singers. The other renowned early account of the blues was written by W.C. Handy in his 1941 autobiography, ambitiously titled The Father of the Blues. In 1903, he was a cornet and guitar player leading a small Delta dance orchestra when one night, stuck in the train station at Tutwiler, Mississippi, about 30 miles south of Coahoma and 15 miles outside Clarksdale, a lean, loose-jointed Negro had commenced plunking a guitar beside me while I slept. His clothes were rags, his feet peeped out of his shoes. His face had on it some of the sadness of the ages. As he played, he pressed a knife on the strings of the guitar in a manner popularized by Hawaiian guitarists who used steel bars. The effect was unforgettable. His song, too, struck me instantly. The singer repeated the line three times, accompanying himself on the guitar with the weirdest music I had ever heard. Handy and Peabody are usually paired in books like this as clear evidence of a vivid music unique to the Mississippi Delta. Handy called it a kind of earthborn music. Earthborn is exactly synonymous with autochthonous, which is a synonym for indigenous. Somewhat undercutting his claim to be the music's father and the theory of others that it originated in the Delta, Handy also said that it was familiar throughout the Southland. Peabody's Trench Diggers and Handy's Depot Guitarists are essential figures in a folklore describing how music rooted in African modalities and created by Mississippi sharecroppers was captured in the recordings of Delta performers, that it was part of the great black migration to the North, especially to Chicago, where it took on an electric, sexy, big city throb that captured the imaginations of young white people as nothing quite had before. Next stop on the narrative is inevitably how it gave birth to rock and roll. That broad outline is fundamentally correct, but like most broad outlines, it hides a lot. For example, after decades of looking, no one has ever discovered any musical forms in Africa that can be considered to be the clear and unambiguous roots of the blues. The writer Francis Davis puts it succinctly in The History of the Blues. To hear the blues as a West African import creates its own share of confusion. In the absence of recorded evidence, we can't even trace the blues back to slavery, much less Africa. Blues historians, erring on the side of caution, date the birth of the form to the late 19th century, in the wake of Reconstruction. As Davis notes, even W.C. Handy goes on to allow that his fondness for that sort of thing began a decade or so earlier. If the music was, as Handy said, familiar throughout the Southland, then the origin may well be much earlier than the late 19th century, to a time when the Delta was still the haunt of Indian panther and bear. Historically, the ubiquity of the music has been credited to itinerant musicians in the minstrel and medicine shows that toured the rural South, playing to black and white audiences from the 1840s until the Great Depression. Increasing rail connections in the same period, where track miles more than doubled in the South between 1880 and 1890, are also considered an influence. But we must guard against mistaking catalyst for cause. While increased communication between once isolated communities undoubtedly helped musical styles evolve, it does not explain why Handy felt the music was at once so familiar and so weird. With the advent of the electronic microphone in 1925, the old, harsh, nasal style of singing, useful at a time when singers had to be heard in noisy places, gave way for subtler vocal effects, including quietly sung phrases, spoken asides, and falsetto vocals. In his book, Deep Blues, the writer Robert Palmer notes specifically that falsetto singing is an African effect. Bantu vocalizing, he wrote, includes whooping or sudden jumping into falsetto range, which seems to derive from the Pygmies, who were the area's original inhabitants. In raising the idea of an indigenous geographic influence on musical style, Palmer never considers what connection Peabody's Ditch Diggers, with whom he begins Deep Blues, may have had with the original inhabitants of Coahoma County. Neither does he mention that falsetto singing is also a feature of Native American music, where it represents the voices of spirits. One senses something in Palmer's writing that the author can't quite name. Consider his description of Muddy Waters, born McKinley Morganfield, on the occasion of Waters' first recording session in a shack in Stovall in 1940 for the song collector Alan Lomax. Muddy was a vigorous 26-year-old, Palmer writes, with high cheekbones and cool, hooded eyes, features that lent him a certain oriental inscrutability. The question of North America's original or indigenous inhabitants hardly ever comes up in popular histories of American music, the assumption being that the land inhabited by the European arrivals and their slaves had been mainly clear of earlier people and empty of song. Africa and the British Isles were seen as the only available sources of the music that evolved from that place and time. The possibility that the musical traditions of indigenous peoples might be central to American harmony has never been articulated, much less considered at length. This is pretty remarkable, not only because so many of the musicians, black, white, and brown, had pronounced Native American roots, but by the given historical details of the settlement of the North American continent. Professor Peabody's reactions to the working men's songs, monotonous and weird, he said, is pretty much how Europeans describe American Indian music. That Peabody may have been closer to the mark when he said that the music sounded Asian is, for many, counterintuitive. Between 1600 and 1840, three cultures, Native American, African, and European, each with a highly evolved choral tradition, came to encounter one another in war and peace, by chance and under duress, in the old and new settlements of the vast American interior east of the Mississippi. To assume that only one of these cultures predominated in how the music evolved, or that another had no influence whatsoever, flies not only against logic, but also in the face of any practical knowledge about how musicians work. And given the ubiquity of the music across the South and the flexibility of its form, we might consider if, rather than being transmitted from blacks to whites, the blues had been gained commonly by both. And what we now call blues and country music are divergent branches of a single root, one indigenous to North America. The blues, the popular 20th century song form, came first from the blues, a way of feeling in music, the flatted notes and vocal swoops, those high and lonesome sounds, sung by some as a hoot and by others like a yodel, were heard in Texas and Oklahoma, Virginia and Tennessee. Those sounds varied, of course, from region to region, depending on what different people wanted to hear, but not so much as to be unrecognizable. There was indeed something like a shock of recognition when phonograph records finally let people at one end of the South hear music from the other. Black people in Arkansas enjoyed country stars like Jimmie Rodgers and Uncle Dave Macon. One mountain musician, Roscoe Holcomb, years later recalled first hearing a blues record by Blind Lemon Jefferson, a black man from Texas, and feeling something inside himself set free. So that's the introductory section. So is there any questions, comments?
I guess I didn't realize that the guitar was prominent in the time of dish singers or...
like the late 19th century.
Yes.
Yeah.
I thought it was still banjo at that period up until the guitar became sort of something you could order by...
Sure. Well, that had happened pretty much like starting in the 1880s. This is the guitar part of the book. But by then you had enormous manufacturers here in Chicago where they were sending out guitars. And one of the developments was that they had, in fact, because these instruments had to be sent over long distances over very rough means, the guitars were made bigger and stronger and consequently louder. And so that then you were able to, you know, sort of send them out. And so by the 1890s, early, by 1900s, in about 1901 also was the first time that they put metal strings on guitars, because guitars were by then so large and sturdy. So, yeah.
Do you know what the kind of ratio of guitar to banjo was at that point? Because
No. I would say banjos are still more a homemade instrument. There was something of a fad for mandolins, which were very popular at the time, and that's where, in fact, the metal strings on guitars came from. They were taken from mandolins, and somebody had the idea of putting mandolin strings on guitars. So.
Oh, that's great.
Oh, okay. All right, moving on.
The idea that nobody thought to wonder about, you know, what was the Native Americans' contribution to, you know, what was going on culturally. That's just an interesting thought. To assume that, well, there were the European Americans, and then there was the African Americans, and just to ignore the reality of Native Americans.
I look into that. There's in a later chapter, I sort of wondered why that happened, and just found out it was really sort of fads and academic inquiry that in, you know, universities around the turn of the century, the turn of the 20th century, what had been, you know, anthropology departments studying Native American artifacts and culture had finally decided that probably because these societies were considered to be in decline, if not vanishing completely, that they would now turn their attention to other cultures, specifically, a lot of cultures, but in the United States, immigrants and African Americans, and so that then became the focus of academic research. And so, 50 years later. When people started wondering where this music came from, the whole notion of there being Indians at all in the scene was just kind of lost from the overall myth. So,
it also seems remarkable, and maybe you're going to get there, because of the long history of interactions between Cherokees and African Americans, between all sorts of African Americans and Native people throughout the Southeast in particular.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah, we got a long section in the book.
A lot of that in there. So I'll go on. It wasn't until after the Plains tribes had been confined during the era of Wild West shows that anything like a comprehensive survey of Native American music was made. Even then, it was limited to those people west of the Mississippi, in which the old ways were still a living memory. A groundbreaking study appeared in 1893, a monograph from the Peabody Museum, a study of Omaha Indian music written by the ethnologist Alice Fletcher. Soon after beginning fieldwork with the Omaha a decade before, Fletcher became seriously ill and spent several months, she said, recuperating in the field, ministered to in part by Indian friends who, often at my request, sang for me. In hearing the Indians, what had begun as a frustrating case study suddenly took on a new life, Fletcher recalled. They sang softly because I was weak and there was no drum, and then it was that the distraction of noise and the confusion of theory were dispelled, and the sweetness and beauty and meaning of these songs were revealed to me. Her paper describes broad characteristics she found in Indian music, and with the help of two assistants, one Native American, the other a classically trained musician, provided piano transcriptions, admitted approximations of Indian songs. The scores tempi, meant to stand for drumming, vary wildly, though 2-4 and 4-4 rhythms predominate. There was no melody to speak of, or it was rather utterly flexible to the needs of the singer and lyric. Chants, usually of one or two phrases, repeated over and over. There was no set key. Rather, each singer used whatever felt comfortable to them. Though the remarkable variety and uses of songs, Fletcher reported, could change among tribes, styles were widely transmitted. Indian songs, I have discovered, travel far, and those of one tribe are soon at home in another. Vocal techniques included tremolo effects and falsetto and bass singing, descriptive mimicry of voices and rhythms, also played a significant role. The songs used a pentatonic five-note scale, a de facto blues form, and abrupt modal jumps to tonic fifth and seventh, so-called blue notes, were employed frequently in the transcriptions made by Fletcher's assistants. Indian songs, Fletcher noted, were often specific testimonies of the singers themselves, using words that were often taken apart or modified so as to make them more melodious. Many songs are furnished wholly with syllables which are not parts or even fragments of words, but sounds that lend themselves easily to singing. That the above also describes something a lot like yodeling or moaning should not be overlooked. Indeed, the vocal techniques of such Delta performers as Howlin' Wolf, Charlie Patton, Ishmael Bracey, and Robert Johnson are all categorized by techniques Fletcher observed among Omaha singers. Another blues player, a street preacher from Texas, Blind Willie Johnson, recorded only religious numbers and was noted for his open-tuned slide guitar playing and growling singing voice. Johnson's growl especially resembles the throat singing still extant in remote parts of Asia. His wordless, moaning, three-minute slide guitar meditation on the crucifixion, Dark as the Night, is transfixing, one of the essential expressions of the American soul. Music is no mere diversion from the Indian point of view, the musicologist Frederick R. Burton wrote in 1909. It is not separated from ordinary experience by being classed as an art, but is a feature of daily homely use and necessity. The Indian has a song for everything, his god, his friends, and his enemies, the animals he hunts and the maiden he woos, the forest that sighs around him. Though redolent of running maiden romanticism and ignoring the role of female vocalists, Burton grasped music's essential presence for native people. When W.C. Handy described how he came to comprehend music in childhood, his language is nearly the same. As a child, I had not heard the pipe of Pan, but pastoral melody was nevertheless a very real thing to me. Whenever I heard the song of a bird, I could visualize the notes in the scale. I knew the gait of horses by the rhythm of their hooves. As I grew older, I added the saxophonic wailing of moo cows and the clarinets of the moody whippoorwills. This was the primitive prelude to the mature melodies recognized as the blues. Elsewhere, Hardy recalls how fond he was of hunting with a bow and arrow and notes how skilled Grandma Thamuthis, she who said his ears were so special, was at Herbal Remedies. The ability to heal with native plants was everywhere at that time considered an Indian art, a knowledge technology that grew from centuries of observation passed on, perhaps as legacy, by indigenous people to their new relations. Rural churches may well have been where musical styles met and combined. Missionaries established extensive social connections to Native Americans, and traditions of musical worship might remain in a region even after the local Indian society there was abolished. Indeed, church music may have been the main way assimilated people allowed themselves to feel the power of the old life. Shape note singing, favored by Baptists who considered musical instruments the devil's playthings, was also widely popular amongst the southern tribes. Knowing this, one cannot now listen to examples of this haunting choral music without hearing certain harmonic dissonances that resemble nothing quite so much as full-throated Native American psalmody. East of the Mississippi, writes the global musicologist Bruno Nettle, the most distinctive feature is the development of responsorial singing, shouts thrown back and forth between leader and chorus. Here, of course, is another putative African trait, one observed in early black churches and attributed also to English Protestant services. Whatever its provenance, call and reply singing was evident among all three groups of the Eastern frontier early enough in their common history so as to make it finally impossible to judge who exactly got it from whom. We all good?
Just in response to Ben, one of the fascinating parts of the book is the history of the interaction between African Americans and Native Americans in the Southeast. So mm-hmm. maybe you could go into some of that.
I find a section and see if I don't. All right.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Quick question. So, what kind of are there any recordings of Native Americans made during this time, or you know, photographed first?
Yes, a woman named Frances Densmore was. I'm not sure if she was an exact contemporary of Alice Fletcher, but around that time, around the turn of the century, made quite a few, I think, cylinder recordings. And I believe her studio was in Washington. She was attached to some organization. I wish I could be more specific, but her subjects came to her and sang. As far as field recordings, I'm sure there are some, but I wouldn't know for sure. They would have all been recordings of Western, sort of the Plains tribes, or even further west than that, and not the you might say the tribes that had been sort of ethnically cleansed from the south. So.
There are recordings. I mean, are they still available?
I would imagine you could, a place like archive.com or the Library of Congress. I know the Library of Congress does have some of Densmore's recordings. So. Though the American experience leading to the Civil War has long been under examination, it is only recently that the specific subject of the social survival of fugitive and marginalized people, so-called triracial isolates, during that period, has preoccupied historians and genealogists. Even so, the broad artistic results of that mixing in stories and music have never been considered until very recently. Fiddle players of any color were welcome everywhere in the antebellum South. Slave musicians were rented or loaned to neighboring plantations for dances. Some owners allowed slaves to keep what they earned playing music. Needless to say, these itinerant musicians had a tremendous social mobility and, carrying their means of support with them, made for very successful escapees. Historical accounts of early American black music are replete with old classified ads offering rewards for fugitive musicians. 1745, ran away from Captain Joseph Hale of Newbury, a Negro man named Cato, took with a violin and can play well thereon. 1748, ran away from his master, Elizur Ting, Esquire, a Negro man servant called Robin, almost of the complexion of an Indian, talks good English, can read and write, and plays the fiddle. 1734, runaway, the 26th of June last, from Samuel Leonard of Perth Amboy in New Jersey, a thick, short fellow having but one eye. His name is Juan. He is half Negro and half Indian. He had on, when he went away, a blue coat. He plays the fiddle and speaks good English, and his country Indian. As far back as 1819, in a tract meant to correct doctrinal error in Methodist congregations, when John Watson observed, "In the blacks' quarter of Philadelphia, the colored people get together and sing for hours together, in the merry chorus maker manner of the southern harvest field or husking frolic, method of the slave blacks, and also very greatly like the Indian dances." 150 years earlier, Morgan Godwin, another minister after a brief sojourn in Virginia, returned to England horrified by the abject state of the Negroes and Indians. Godwin claimed to have witnessed idolatry among the blacks, for that they used their dances as a means to procure rain. The historian Denna Epstein notes that the first purchase of American Indian artifacts by the British Museum in 1753. Among the objects from America was an Indian drum made of hollowed tree, carved the top, being braced with pegs and thongs with the bottom hollow, from Virginia. A 20th century curator cataloging the drum notes, "Although described as Indian, this drum was more probably made by Negroes and may even have been brought from Africa. The drum is typical of the Ashanti of Ghana. It is unlikely to have dawned on the British curator that the drum may have indeed been a genuine Indian artifact, as he or she likely had no idea what genuine Indian means, provided it has any meaning at all. And here, I looked into how the myth of the blues being African, having roots in Africa, was formed in the first place, and it went back, for what I could find, to a man named Alan Lomax, who was a very famous and important archivist who did a great deal of preservation and, you know, preserving recording songs and of all kinds across the United States and through Europe.